We'll call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Wednesday, February 6th. We have one bill on our agenda today. That's Senate File 5 with Senator Kathy Sharon. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning and thank you. In your packet, I'd like you to refer to your packet. You should have some fiscal note on this bill. That's passed through health policy and is here for this committee's review. I also wanted to draw your attention to I think it's it's the third page, is a description. It's labeled S0005-6A. It is your fiscal note, and then it should be a 6A number on it because some of our late starters, because we had a little confusion about having the right fiscal note in my packet. And then the behind the fiscal note is a sheet that I'd like you to pull out and note. It's really a description that I thought was helpful in our policy committee and might be helpful here as well, that shows you who the group or the population is that is being impacted by this legislation, what their current MA income limits are, what the proposed MA income limits will be for those populations. And also, I thought it would be interesting for us to all see what the implications of that are in real dollars for a household, you know, what the income levels are that we're talking about that are reflected for the people who would become eligible for this for this program. And with that, we will begin to discuss the bill. Give me a moment. There's been a lot of discussion over the last several years about the Affordable Care Act and what the rationale and reasons are for why we like it or do not like it. We've had arguments about whether or not it should be implemented or not, but it is now the law of the land, and what we are doing this year is a great deal of activity to bring our state in compliance with the Affordable Care Act. What, in relationship to today's bill, the Affordable Care Act allows a state to cover those vulnerable individuals with comprehensive and affordable insurance through Medicaid. And beginning in January 2014, states can expand Medicaid to cover all non-elderly individuals with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty line. And the sheet that I handed out shows you that, for example, that's $15,415 for an individual. It's a great deal for Minnesota, which is acknowledged and recognized already as a leader in creating health insurance options for struggling families. The key goal of the Affordable Care Act is for everyone to have health insurance. And by expanding access to affordable and comprehensive health insurance to very low-income individuals through Medicaid, it's a critical step in order to accomplish that goal of everybody being covered. So with that, I'll walk you through the bill. I would preface it by saying that there are other bills coming in the future to address this population. And the fiscal note that you have is really addressing only the issues that are articulated in this bill language. So Senate File 5 expands medical assistance eligibility up to 133% for parents and single adults without children. And it in Section 1 defines the Affordable Care Act. In Section 2, I may have the wrong, I want to make sure I have the right bill review here. I may have given away my copy. Thank you. this was part of this morning's confusion. My content here, the content that I need in front of you is not the content that was in front of you. So it expands medical assistance eligibility up to 133% for parents and children ages 19 to 20 and single adults without children. It also makes federally required changes to the medical assistance program by implementing the use of a modified adjusted gross income as a standard disregard, and we'll talk about what that means. Section 1 defines Affordable Care Act. Section 2 specifies that children who are 19 and 20 years of age are eligible for the medical assistance program. Section 3 states that in January 2014, the income eligibility shall be determined by using this modified adjusted gross income and standard income disregard for allowing populations, children under the age of 19 and their parents, and relative caretakers, as well as children 19 and 20. It allows pregnant women, infants up to the age of 2, and adults without children to use this eligibility determination model that is referred to as MAGI. Section 4 removes some unnecessary language. Section 5 specifies the asset limitations only apply to parents and caretakers, relatives who qualify for MA with a spend down. And to clarify that, sometimes a person reaches the eligibility standard because they calculate out all a variety of significant medical expenses, and that brings the person down under 138% of poverty. It is that group that would be restricted under Section 5. I think I've said that correctly. And Section 6 increases MA income eligibility for parents and relative caretakers up to 133% of poverty guidelines for children. And this, without reading through the overview, again, would refer you back to the sheet that we've prepared for you that shows who the income groups are and how it changes their current stature to what the bill affords in for this population. And Section 6 transfers funds from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund to pay for these health care services. And with that, I would ask the chair whether or not you would like me to introduce our amendment to this bill before we have Mr. Leitz articulate more clarity for the bill.
This is not the right.
Has the amendment been distributed? Is that something?
There is an amendment that has yet to be distributed.
Is it a delete everything amendment? Is that? Is it, what's the nature of the amendment? Is it significant? Is it necessary so that we understand what's going to be proposed? I mean, would it be a waste of time to start stepping through the bill?
Yes, I think it would probably and certainly gives an opportunity for everybody to understand the essence of the bill first before we move forward.
Let's okay. Entertain the amendment then.
We'll proceed with the testimony if you don't mind before
okay.
We do the amendment.
Proceed with the testimony then. Well.
The amendment will make more sense after we have
okay.
more clarification.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. I do come here today in support of Senator Sharon's bill. I want to thank Senator Sharon for her leadership on this issue. This mirrors an item that's in the governor's budget to expand medical assistance for single adult populations as well as 19 and 20-year-old children and and parents up to 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. The governor brought forth this option because we felt that it was a good move for the state to do overall. It was good for taxpayers, it was good for Minnesotans, and it was good for healthcare providers, and just a good policy decision for the state to make, generally speaking. We will be bringing in additional folks under the medical assistance expansion here that will allow those individuals who are low income, who are working, and who pay taxes to support other government health care programs to receive coverage that's necessary for the services that they need. There will be folks who are currently – some of these populations are currently people who are covered in our Minnesota Care program, and that's been a longstanding program in the state. Some of these people will be moving into medical assistance where they will receive better coverage at a lower cost than they currently do in the Minnesota Care program. And we'll be able to cover a number of additional Minnesotans under this proposal. And it's important to note that because we'll be bringing these individuals in under the Medicaid expansion, that's optional for states to do. The way the federal government has structured this is to allow for full federal funding for those populations for the first 3 years, and a phase down to 90% cover 90% of the cost beyond that point. We currently cover many of these populations at 50% cost. And so what you end up with is a cost savings because of that, as the federal government covers the full cost of the program for the first several years and then covers the majority of the cost thereafter. We also think the bill is very good for healthcare providers in our state. I think Minnesota has a long and proud tradition of healthcare providers participating in Medicaid. We have one of the highest participation rates in the country, both at the hospital and physician levels. But one of the things that those physicians and hospitals need to deal with is uncompensated care, and that's because we still do have Minnesotans who lack health insurance coverage. As the bill is, if the bill were to be passed and expansion was to go forward, we would cover additional Minnesotans under the bill, and that would be an offset for hospitals to their uncompensated care levels, which we believe is a good thing for financial stability of healthcare providers in our state, and also for the folks, obviously, who are seeking care, who will be able to have coverage, will seek it in a more cost-effective way because they have health insurance coverage, seeking care up front as opposed to waiting until they're sick and going to the emergency rooms. I do want to take just a moment to mention that while we do this expansion, you know, this is not Medicaid as it has been. I think we all recognize that for us to be able to have a maintain a system of good coverage for people, that we need to do so in a sustainable way over time. Certainly the federal funding is an assistance in doing that. Even with that federal funding, however, the costs of the program are challenging at times. And so we've made a number of changes within the Medicaid program to make sure that the delivery system that we use for Medicaid is an effective and efficient one. There was an announcement just last week by the governor that we had entered into agreements with six healthcare organizations, five hospital systems, and one set of federally qualified health centers, community clinics that serve our clients. To move Medicaid enrollees into new models of care, where the incentives for both the enrollee and the healthcare provider are to keep costs as low as possible while delivering high cost outcomes. It changes the system from one where there was an incentive to simply do more care to people because you got paid for every service, to one where hospitals and the clinics will actually have an incentive to work with us collaboratively to figure out ways to better manage care for our chronically ill population. So I think our hospital community has been real leaders in this, and I think we're very happy to have that new program started January 1st of this year for those six clinics, or for those six initial groups. They'll be serving about 100,000 of our enrollees in that new system. And we also rolled out a new request for proposals for new organizations to join this new model of care. So I think we fully believe and understand that as we do the expansion, this is that we need to also continue to transform our healthcare system to make it much more effective and efficient. And then finally, Mr. Chair, as I mentioned, overall, this is just a good deal for the state. We do cover many of these populations currently in Minnesota Care. We'll be moving them to medical assistance where we'll receive full federal funding for them, and that will create a cost savings for the state. And so for all those reasons, this was included in the governor's budget. Again, I want to thank Senator Sharon for her leadership on bringing forth this bill, and we do, as the administration, stand strongly in support of it.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer, you had?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering when we're going to have the delete all amendment that we can have in our
hands.
It's
not a delete all amendment. We got that clarified. I had asked. There was a delete all amendment in the policy committee. Sorry for the confusion. They said that the amendment would make more sense after describing the bill. It's not going to be a fundamental change in the bill. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, I just have a little confusion here. On the fiscal note on page 2, under the assumptions, it states that the fiscal note was drafted as if Minnesota Care is going to continue as a coverage option, but then it goes on to say that this should not be taken to confirm that the Minnesota Care program can continue to exist in its current form once the ACA is implemented. Your testimony, from what I'm reading into it, and you can correct me, please do if I'm wrong, that MinnesotaCare isn't going to continue. Is that the case?
Mr. Leitz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, thank you. It is a little bit of a confusing area, so let me see if I can clarify up kind of what I was saying. What we currently have in place in the MinnesotaCare program is we cover adult populations up to 200% of the federal poverty line, so single adult populations, and then parents up to 275. What the bill in front of you does is to expand Medicaid eligibility up to 138% of poverty, so covering some of the populations that we currently cover in our MinnesotaCare program. MinnesotaCare would, sort of continues to cover folks above that eligibility level. Where there has been some uncertainty up to this point has been, and continues to be a little bit as we move forward, we're hoping to get a little bit more clarity very soon on this, is that with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in 2014, states have the option of covering folks above 138 of poverty, moving them into the health insurance exchange where they'll receive advanced premium tax credits for their coverage. Or optionally, states can continue. We could continue to operate the MinnesotaCare program as we have. I think it's our preference that we do so under an option that's in the Affordable Care Act called the Basic Health Plan option, which would allow us to get a different set of funding to continue that program moving forward. And so I think what the fiscal note is reflecting is that there's just uncertainty right now around which of those options the state will need to pursue, and it depends a lot on federal guidance and when we receive that federal guidance. I know that the governor, I believe, talked with Secretary Sebelius yesterday about that issue. We're pushing very hard to get that so that we can bring much more clarity to the process moving forward, so that we know if we're going to be operating in a MinnesotaCare environment or an exchange environment. So I think the fiscal note really reflects that uncertainty right now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up to that, worst-case scenario, how is that going to affect the fiscal note in terms of expenses to the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I believe the fiscal note is written at this point in time to not really – I don't know that it really impacts upon this fiscal note. What it will impact is, I think as Senator Sharon mentioned, there will be some additional bills coming forward later that will obviously, depending on how the discussions with the federal government turn out, would have some effects on those. I don't know specifically the effects at any level of precision, because I don't think that there hasn't been bill language to do that. This fiscal note, I think, as it stands, however, as the language is wouldn't necessarily be impacted by those things.
So, Mr. Leitz, the way I read the fiscal note, and I did go over it last night myself, it really tracks the movement from our historic MinnesotaCare program just with this implementation of Medicaid expansion and the movement between our current MinnesotaCare program under current law, which is what, is all we have really to work with at this stage of the game. There is uncertainty about the future of the MinnesotaCare program, but if we do this, we can project what movement there will be between MinnesotaCare as we've known it and what Medicaid will allow if this expansion were to occur. So, if you get in and read the tracking of the shifts between the two, I think the assumptions are pretty sound. And then that this paragraph that you're mentioning on page 2 is just acknowledging that there are going to be additional items that can have effects elsewhere in the budget as well. With that, Senator Benson?
To that point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Leitz, so does the current federal law allow us to choose the option, or the current federal law would direct us to the exchange and we're asking for an exemption? I just need clarification, please.
Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, our reading is that the current federal law allows us to choose either option. Where we've been stymied to this point has been to allow us to choose that option. The federal government needs to have issued, from their perspective, have issued guidance on how they're going to implement that option, and they have yet to do so. But from our perspective, it should be an option that we can ask for as opposed to an exception to what would otherwise be the requirement.
Senator Benson, a follow-up.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz, have any other states had luck in getting this second option? And, because this is taking forever, and I, with each passing day, I'm less and less confident that the feds will let us out of the box.
Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I do know of a number of states that have had discussions with the federal government on the issue. To date, they haven't issued any guidance on this issue, so none of the other states have been able to take advantage of that. I do know that in discussions with the federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, you know, what we've indicated with the overarching Health and Human Services Agency, that where we really need clarity is by fiscal by the end of February for us to be able to have information in front of the legislature that is tied to the February forecast. So we are on that track. We certainly are wanting it sooner than that, but that has been kind of our discussion with them to date.
So
and just for clarity for the audience and anybody watching, this discussion is around the BHP guidance, not around the Medicaid expansion that is the subject of this bill. Just to be clear, I think there's oftentimes in the community a conflation of all of these issues into one. And, in the fiscal note, we have a paragraph that is in bold, actually, when you open up the fiscal note, and it really highlights the fact that we are working on BHP and there is some uncertainty around it. But this bill is about the effects and the financial implications of doing an expansion to 138% of the federal poverty level for our Medicaid program. And I think that, you know, if we can, we can certainly entertain a few more questions on the BHP, but pretty soon we're going to need to focus our attention on the Medicaid expansion effects. Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to get
it's,
so far
it's
off
good.
Track. I'm going to just try to, will any decision on the BHP have a fiscal impact on this note?
Mr. Chair, Leitz. Senator Benson, no, that won't be the case.
Okay, then let's delete this paragraph in future fiscal notes. Thank you, Mr. Leitz.
It was an important point to make, though. I think I'm glad that it's in the fiscal note, and I'm glad that we teased that out on the record a little bit. But back to the Medicaid expansion itself. Any further questions of members? If not, I see we do have a number of testifiers who would like to give their thoughts. So we will call, there it is, buried already, Dr. Michael Belzer, the medical director with HCMC. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Dr. Michael Belzer, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Hennepin County Medical Center, a position that I've held for over 23 years. To remind you, Hennepin County Medical Center is the state's oldest and largest safety net hospital, providing services to the uninsured and underinsured in our community and in that role that we've played for over 125 years. So I appreciate the opportunity to solicit your support for the very important Medicaid expansion, Senate File 5. Minnesota has a great opportunity to further reduce the number of uninsured and low-income individuals by accepting the federal option to expand Medicaid to 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. Currently, the income limit for childless adults is 75% of the poverty level, or about $8,500 a year. And this expansion would raise that upper income level to $14,800 or less. Just for context for my following comments, I'd just like to remind folks that the average price for a private insurance premium or a policy for a single person is $6,000 per year, and for a family policy is nearly $16,000 per year. So poor uninsured patients do precisely what you and I would do if we were in their shoes, and that rather than paying 60 to 90% of their income for a health insurance policy, they choose to pay their rent or buy food for their families, and thus they go uninsured. So coverage with medical insurance like Medicaid is good. Lack of health insurance is not. I'm sure you've heard that folks say that the uninsured can get all the care that they need. They just go to emergency departments in hospitals or to community clinics, and what's the big deal if they have to wait longer than they would if they went to private doctor offices? Well, unfortunately, that's not true, because multiple lines of very credible research and evidence clearly point that lack of health insurance is more than an inconvenience in the location where patients receive care. A fact is that uninsured patients have worse health status at every age. They're sicker and they die younger. Recent published studies demonstrate a 40% increase in mortality or excess deaths each year solely due to lack of health insurance. And if you translate that into individuals, that's 45,000 United States residents die each year, that's one every 12 minutes, solely because they lack health insurance. And why do they have the higher death rate? They delay care, they don't purchase medications, they don't come to the doctor with early disease, and they wait until far advanced disease presents them to the emergency department, and you can obviously see that connection. And in fact, if uninsurance were categorized as a disease, if we were to call uninsurance a disease, it would be the third leading killer of the near elderly, just behind heart disease and cancer. So with that preamble, let me give you several reasons why I think you should support Senate File 5. Number one, uninsurance kills. We just mentioned 45,000 U.S. residents each year, one death every 12 minutes. Additional coverage. The expansion to 138% of the federal poverty level will cover an additional 57,000 to 75,000 Minnesotans, in addition to the nearly 85,000 Minnesotans who are presently covered under the Medicaid early expansion initiative of 2011. Three, expanded Medicaid saves lives. Interestingly, a recent study from the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine that was published early because of the impact and importance from the Harvard Public School of Health studied a group of childless adults who received early Medicaid expansion, compared their mortality rates before and after Medicaid expansion, and compared mortality rates to four neighboring states, controlling for healthy behaviors, education, and so on. And very interestingly, death increased in the control groups, the states that did not have Medicaid expansion, and deaths decreased to a significant degree in those states with Medicaid expansion. Reason four, state budget savings. You've heard recently that the Medicaid expansion will save the state approximately $1.4 billion for this coverage over a four-year period, freeing up state resources for other critical needs. Five, maintenance of important essential community services. Medicaid expansion covers the reimbursed costs for hospitals that allow them to do very necessary, important community services that, let's say, are not profit centers. And let's take Hennepin County Medical Center that I'm very familiar with. We have a poison control center, a psychiatric emergency department, trauma and a burn center, stand-ready capacity. I'm sure you remember the I-35 bridge collapse. Hospitals cannot continue these important community services with continued federal and state cuts in reimbursement. So Medicaid expansion would allow hospitals like ours to continue these important services. And finally, as Mr. Leitz suggested, there's the innovation in healthcare that's so much needed as part of this plan. As partners with Hennepin Health, that's the name of our Medicaid ACO in the county, we are trying to find ways to improve care that early Medicaid expansion population receives, and its improvement outside of the traditional model of delivery of acute health care. So in 2012, with Hennepin Health, that's our ACO again, we helped 100 of the sickest clients access affordable housing and stabilize their health. We've created health care homes, increased visits with teams, decreasing emergency department visits, and we're getting ready for the next group of Medicaid expansion population by making behavioral health care more available in our primary clinics, adding mental health professionals to those teams, and other services. So let me finish with one patient story that, and believe me, there are many, but let me just give one story that sort of outlines how the innovation in healthcare and care model design from Hennepin Health is significant. John is a male who lost his job about 12 years ago, and additionally he lost his home and his family, and he was forced to live in various shelters around the Twin Cities. He came to the Hennepin County Emergency Department because he felt there was something wrong with his feet, and in fact, he was right. He had undiagnosed diabetes and multiple foot ulcers, and his feet literally had ulcerous holes. He received the treatment and the education and surgery that he needed, several surgeries to repair his feet, and within a week of release from the hospital, John was attacked, thrown into an automobile trunk, and set on fire. So he was brought again to Hennepin County Emergency Department with severe burns to his face and hands. And finally, because of the Hennepin Health Program and the fact he met the criteria, we were able to connect him with Hennepin Health. And due to his diabetes, he needed housing. We arranged it. Depression medication, we arranged it. Intensive home health care to manage his bandages and wounds so he didn't need to come back to expensive care in the hospital. And we were able to prevent further infection and get him back on his feet with the affordable housing and the intensive care. And so John subsequently began volunteering at a nursing home and has joined a group to reduce violence in the community. And if you ask him, he'll say Hennepin Health is the best thing that ever happened to him. And you can see how this is different from the traditional model of acute health care where we rely on patients to access the system like coming to the hospital. So in conclusion, I urge you to support Senate File 5, Medicaid expansion. As we mentioned, uninsurance is a fatal disease with a 40% excess mortality and 45,000 unnecessary deaths each year. The published studies in the New England Journal of Medicine and others that show mortality is decreased with increased access to Medicaid through the Medicaid expansion. Estimates say it will provide coverage to more than 170,000 Minnesotans who are presently uninsured. That's including the present early expansion Medicaid patients, will save in the state nearly $1.4 billion over the four-year period for their coverage. Patients benefit, hospitals benefit, providers benefit, the community and state benefit specifically from these very threatened services like poison centers, acute psychiatric emergency departments, hyperbaric oxygen chambers, really important suicide prevention, services that you don't realize their importance until you need them. And the Medicaid expansion will continue to foster healthcare delivery innovation that's so much needed in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you much, very much, Dr. Belzer. Appreciate your testimony. I need to remind testifiers we have about 12 to go through, and we do need to get this bill done today, so we're going to try to limit testimony to 5 minutes. And with that, Barbara Cox with Health Partners. There she is. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today in support of Senator Sharon's bill, Senate File 5, to expand Medicaid as provided in the Affordable Care Act. I'm Barbara Cox, representing Health Partners. We're an integrated healthcare company with over 20,000 employees in Minnesota across our health plan, clinics, and hospitals, all devoted to our mission of improving the health of our members, patients, and the community. Because of our role as both a payer and a provider of care, we have a unique perspective on the issue of Medicaid expansion, which is why we are in support of this bill. Health Partners strongly supports the Medicaid expansion. In fact, our CEO, Mary Brainerd, was a part of the Governor's Healthcare Reform Task Force and Access Work Group, which recommended this expansion. We thank Senator Sharon and others for authoring it. We support the expansion for three main reasons. It makes sense for patients. Currently, people who have no access to health insurance or only a limited benefit set with copays through Minnesota Care. This will help tens of thousands of Minnesotans gain the health security and access that you and I take for granted. It makes sense for our members. Without the expansion, many people would have to purchase health insurance they can ill afford. This expansion will also keep down premiums in the rest of the market. It makes sense for us as safety net providers. As an organization, we provided almost $30 million in uncompensated care in 2011. We were one of just four providers in the state that stepped up to care for the former GAMC population after the state ended that program and lost millions of dollars doing so. This expansion will help leverage federal funding to alleviate those burdens. We do want to sound some cautions. This is not a silver bullet for providers. How healthcare is paid for is going to change dramatically in the next few years with state and federal reforms. Coverage does not guarantee 100% access, especially with low provider reimbursement rates in Medicaid. This legislation, however, is a great leap forward for our patients, members, and community. We look forward to seeing it signed into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cox. Anna Ashby with Catholic Charities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a handout? If I could
have excellent. Yeah, we'll have that distributed.
Wonderful. Thanks. I do have a copy for you as well. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Ashby, and I'm the public policy organizer for Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. As you know, Catholic Charities is the largest direct service provider in the region, and we serve about 32,000 people each year. Through our housing programs alone, we offer 1,900 guests shelter and housing options each night. Mm-hmm. Catholic Charities strongly supports medical assistance expansion. Our tradition teaches us that human life is sacred and that the dignity of the human person is the starting point for a moral vision for society. We believe that every person has the right to meet their basic needs, which includes access to quality medical care. Medical assistance is crucial for the people we serve. In 2012, we opened a new housing facility in Minneapolis called Higher Ground, which provides a continuum of housing options from emergency care all the way to independent apartments. One man who we were able to serve through Higher Ground was Frank, who has a medical condition that often causes many strokes. Because of these strokes, Frank can lose control of his bowels, fall down to the ground, and lose his memory of the last 15 to 30 minutes. When we admitted Frank into Higher Ground, he had no medical coverage. With the intensive attention and hard work of our staff, he was able to enroll in medical assistance and moved into a pay-for-stay bed that offered him some housing stability. Catholic Charities recognizes the critical connection between health and housing. Without health insurance, Frank hadn't accessed medical care and thus did not have documentation of his condition. This lack of documentation meant that he did not qualify for assisted living, of which he is in serious need. After 4 months on MA with documented medical care, our staff was finally able to help him move into an assisted living community that actually meets his needs. If he hadn't had access to MA and his health condition had continued to go undocumented and untreated, Frank would likely not have survived this winter. MA literally saved his life. Frank is just one person living in poverty who's had trouble accessing medical coverage, but unfortunately this issue plagues many, many Minnesotans. So the graph that we just passed out is research from Catholic Charities that demonstrates the percentage of adults with health insurance coverage according to different income levels. So the y-axis shows percentages of people with access to health insurance, and the x-axis shows five different groups of bars representing the United States all the way down to the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Within each of these groups, we have different colors representing different levels of poverty. The dark blue bar on the left-hand side of each group, for example, represents people living at or below 50% of the federal poverty guideline. The light pink bar on the right-hand side of each group represents people with incomes that put them at 400% of the federal poverty guideline or more. As you can see, throughout Minnesota, and particularly in the metro, people with incomes between 100 and 200% of the poverty threshold were the least likely to have health insurance. Medicaid expansion, which would provide coverage for single adults living up to 138% of the federal poverty guideline, could help us fill this gap in access. In Minnesota, we have a state legacy of going above and beyond when it comes to access to medical care. We do this because we know that without it, people are more vulnerable to poverty, and because with it, they have a much better chance of building a life in which they can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ashby. Mary Krinke with MHA. Welcome to the committee. We'll have a handout distributed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke. I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 144 hospitals and healthcare systems across the state. I know in light of time, Dr. Belzer really did a very nice job of talking about why we support this bill. Not only will it be good for the health of the individual patients who are now eligible for Medicaid, it will also be good for the provider community as well as for the state. I would like just to make a couple points that haven't been made. I know everybody talks about this as being eligibility for adults without children, and I wish we could change the lingo to say adults without minor children. Many of these individuals will be widows in their 60s who have adult children who don't qualify for Medicare yet. So these are adults who aren't eligible for Medicare, who make less than $14,800 a year. But I think many times we misjudge and say that this population is, oh, the healthy 25-year-old male who doesn't have children. And that is very far from the truth. This is a lot of elderly sick people who just haven't reached the Medicare threshold yet. So I'd like to change that lingo to say this is adults without minor children, first of all. Second of all, the numbers keep sort of bouncing around. How many people this represents. Going back to what is in the fiscal note, it's about 87,000 individuals, 53,000 of which are on Minnesota Care. So I think a very important point as we think about this in terms of the state financing, we'll be moving populations that are in Minnesota Care to the Medicaid program. We'll leverage federal dollars by doing that. We'll also improve the benefit set for those individuals. A number of our members have asked me to go on the record and state, while we strongly support this provision, it's been somewhat overlooked that hospitals nationwide took $155 billion with a B in Medicare cuts to help pay for the expansions under the Affordable Care Act. And so now you look at states who may not be doing this, they're really hurting their hospitals that obviously move forward in supporting this Medicaid expansion and helped pay for it with Medicare cuts. Also, there'll be cuts in our DSH funding to help pay for this as well. I'm throughout this hearing, and I heard Scott Leitz talk about the changes in Medicaid delivery. And on Friday, Governor Dayton held a press conference announcing that five of our hospital systems have entered into agreements to help reform Medicaid as we know it. So I want members to understand that while we strongly support these changes and improved eligibility going up to the 138% mark, it doesn't mean that we have to deliver services exactly as we have been delivering them. And I know Senator Kiffmeyer, when she was in the House of Representatives, we had worked on a bill together to do a direct pilot, kind of a contracting model. And that legislation did not go anywhere, Representative Kiffmeyer, as you remember, but it became the basis of this RFP that we did with the Department of Human Services for this contract. So sometimes the reform ideas that you work on now will bear fruit in the future. So in closing, I just want to say we strongly support this legislation. We believe it'll be good for the patients, good for the providers, and good for the state budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Krinke, thank you very much. And I have adults without
minor children.
Mr. Chair. Dependent children. Yes. We'll work our terminology around that. I think it is a very important point. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Krinke. I was looking through the list trying to figure out which testifier might be able to answer this question. What is the current MA reimbursement rate for hospitals?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, right now hospitals statewide are paid at our 2002 costs minus 26%.
And Mr. Chair, can you give us I'm sorry, Ms. Krinke, could you give us translate that into dollars and cents out of every dollar? Can you help us there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, that is difficult to do in that some hospitals receive add-on DSH payments. Some hospitals receive the 16 add-on DRG for our small rural hospitals. The Medicaid program does need to have rebasing done. We've been working with Scott Leitz and others, and we hope to have a proposal this year that would be budget neutral, I might add. But we do need to move forward with the rebasing of our system. It is terribly out of date.
Thank you.
It would obviously be easier if we had a little money we could add to it. But
we're all here interested in that, I believe. Thank you, Ms. Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Christina Wessel with the Minnesota Budget Project.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christina Wessel. I am the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide research, analysis, and advocacy on tax and budget issues, looking particularly at how they impact low- and moderate-income Minnesotans. And so we're very pleased to be here this morning to support Senate File 5, which will improve access to affordable and comprehensive health insurance for 87,000 Minnesotans by expanding eligibility for Medicaid for nearly all adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty line. Passing this bill is really an essential step in expanding health care coverage here in Minnesota. It also has great advantages for the state, for health care providers, and for Minnesota families because it will save the state money, result in fewer unpaid health care bills, and improve health outcomes. We know that Senate File 5 will save the state money. Expanding Medicaid to cover nearly all eligible adults will bring in hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding to Minnesota. The federal government will pick up 100% of the cost for newly eligible Medicaid participants for the first 3 years. The fiscal note shows this bill will bring in nearly $1.2 billion in federal money over the next 4 years into our state to pay for health care for Minnesotans. Senate File 5 will also mean fewer unpaid health care bills. People need health care whether they have insurance or not. And many doctors and hospitals treat patients who do not have insurance knowing they will not be reimbursed for their services. Increasing the number of people with insurance by expanding Medicaid will reduce that amount of uncompensated care. And having more patients able to pay for health care services will help control costs for everyone. And Senate File 5 will remove barriers that currently keep people from enrolling in Medicaid. This bill will allow very low-income families who are trying to build assets to still be eligible for Medicaid. This is extremely important because research shows that increasing savings is a critical step for a family to build enough financial security to move out of poverty. Otherwise, they are always at the brink of financial disaster. Eliminating the asset test for most people in Medicaid will be a big step forward in helping families move towards self-sufficiency. And we know that Senate File 5 will improve health outcomes. The Department of Human Services estimates that this expansion will help 34,000 currently uninsured Minnesotans get access to both affordable and comprehensive health insurance, and will help an additional 53,000 individuals access coverage that is better than what they have right now. This will translate into better health outcomes, stronger and more stable families, and a more productive workforce. But we do need to pass this legislation in order to see these benefits. It is important to note that if Minnesota fails to expand Medicaid, there will be few affordable health insurance alternatives for this population. Unfortunately, we've talked about a little bit today, but we know that Minnesota Care is not a reliable option at this point. While many of these low-income individuals currently may qualify for Minnesota Care, they often can't afford the premiums, or they find that the limited benefits set does not meet their needs. Furthermore, the future of Minnesota Care is in doubt. Some elements of Minnesota Care are not compliant with the Affordable Care Act, and the state is also likely to lose the federal funding that currently helps pay for the program. Without significant changes, Minnesota Care is unlikely to continue to be there for these low-income Minnesotans. And we also know that private insurance in the exchange will be unaffordable for this population. Although some of these individuals will be eligible to receive premium and cost-sharing subsidies in the exchange, private insurance will still not be a viable option. If you look at the family budget for Minnesotans in this income range, they have no money left after paying for essentials like food, housing, transportation, and childcare. They are likely to choose a health care plan in the exchange that has no monthly premiums but has extremely high out-of-pocket costs. This often ends up as a trap for these low-income people who, despite having health insurance, avoid seeking needed medical care because they cannot afford the copays and deductibles. and very low-income individuals, those with incomes below 100% of the poverty line, are not eligible for premium tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies in the exchange because the Affordable Care Act envisioned that they would be covered by Medicaid. Simply put, failure to pass this bill and cover more low-income Minnesotans under Medicaid would push our state backward when it comes to access to comprehensive and affordable health care insurance. We greatly appreciate that Senator Sharon is taking leadership on the issue and that the Senate is moving quickly and early in this session to pass this bill, hopefully before the February forecast, to make sure that Minnesota remains a national leader in health care reform. So we strongly urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wessel. Ron Elwood with Legal Services. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'd like to thank Senator Sharon for authoring the bill, and we fully and wholeheartedly support Senate File 5. As has been discussed, Minnesota currently covers adults without minor children. Should we call that the Krinke Amendment? With incomes up to 75% of federal poverty guidelines under the early MA expansion, one critically important reason to move forward with this bill is because if we do not do the full MA expansion, we will be forced to disenroll those currently covered by the early expansion. And that is because the United States Health and Human Services Department has made clear that expansion is an all-or-nothing proposition. We cannot continue to cover people up to 75% if we refuse to cover people between 75% and 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. So if we do not go down this road, the result would be an unnecessary and unfortunate increase in the number of uninsured Minnesotans, and that would result in seriously adverse economic and human impacts on the individuals and the state, including increased emergency room use, increased uncompensated care has been discussed, increased health care costs across the board, negative employment impacts, decreased school performance, and increased reliance on other economic support programs. So this is a golden opportunity to increase coverage and improve health outcomes for a significant number of Minnesotans, and I thank you for embracing this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Joel Ulan with UCARE. Euland, rather. Apologies.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland, and I am the Assistant Director for Legislative Affairs for UCARE. I am also here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 5. A couple of years ago, we were here in support of the expansion to 75% of the federal poverty guideline, and we are back here again today to support the expansion to 138%. As other testifiers have mentioned, this will benefit some of the Minnesota Care enrollees, and it will provide a benefit for them that they do not currently have, and that is enhancing that hospital cap so that there isn't that $10,000 cap that currently members face. Our staff currently deals with a lot of members where they are avoiding health care services because of that $10,000 cap. And so being able to have these people moving into the medical assistance program will be of great benefit. There's another piece of good news that is worth noting for Minnesota's Medicaid program. Under the Affordable Care Act, primary care physicians who serve our current Medicaid population, as well as the new expansion population, will see an increased payment in 2013 and 2014. That will be no less than the Medicare rates in effect for those 2 years. The federal government will fully fund the difference. Minnesota must first get the payment methodology approved by CMS in order to implement this increased payment, and the payments will be made retroactive once the approval is received and passed through to the health plans and then on to the providers. This move provides some short-term assistance to physicians who have served the Medicaid patients after many years of flat rates and, in some cases, rate cuts by the legislature. This will provide revenue to these providers that they would not have seen if these members would have continued through the Minnesota Care Program. We are excited to see how quickly Senate File 5 is moving through the process, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Euland. Phil Griffin with the Association of Community Health Centers. Oh, that's not Phil coming for. Oh, there he is. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Phil Griffin. I am a contract lobbyist appearing today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I bring your greetings from Jonathan Watson, who was with you yesterday morning, and his apologies for his not being able to be here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers represents 17 federally qualified health care centers offering care at 74 sites throughout the state. Primary care, dental care, and behavioral services are offered at all of these sites. And 40%, nearly 70,000 of our patients are uninsured, one out of every 6 uninsured people in Minnesota. We have a population which has incomes with 95% of them below 200% of the federal poverty level. Mr. Chairman and members, MNAC strongly supports Senate File 5, and we appreciate the opportunity to expand the Medicaid program and the opportunity to testify today. This legislation will have a positive impact on a portion of the 70,000 uninsured that the FQHCs serve. Today, I would like to briefly highlight three benefits of the expansion to our patients. The first is that community health centers provide primary care access for all 185,000 of our patients, regardless of whether they have insurance or do not have insurance. But we do see difficulty that our uninsured patients have in having access to specialty providers. For instance, uninsured diabetic health center patients are much less likely to be able to see an endocrinologist. MA expansion will increase the likelihood that our patients will receive specialty care and will be able to manage their chronic conditions much better. Left unchecked, untreated, those chronic conditions can prove costly to our system and to our patients. Second, if we are to address the glaring health disparities of some of the populations in our state, coverage is one piece of the solution. The uninsured rate of Latinos, American Indians, and African Americans are 2 to 3 times higher than the state average, and based on the projections provided to the Governor's Health Care Reform Task Force, Medicaid expansion will clearly have a huge impact on reducing these alarming disparities. Third and lastly, Medicaid expansion promotes affordable care for low-income individuals. While CHCs serve 70,000 uninsured without question, there are uninsured that forego primary care at community health centers and other primary care providers altogether due to cost. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we are prepared at the community health centers to expand our coverage so that we can treat those patients that come into this system and hope that you will pass Senate File 5 and move it to the governor as quickly as possible. Mr. Chairman, I just have to add one thing to Ms. Krinke's testimony. We did add 5 new hospitals. We also added one group of 10 community health centers to that group of new Medicaid programs, and we don't want to be left out, so the committee knows that those exciting things are happening. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association.
Morning, members. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. We are a professional association representing more than 10,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout the state. And we are also here today very pleased to be able to support Senate File 5, the expansion of the medical assistance program. You've heard from many groups their top 3 or 4 reasons. We also have 3 reasons. I will try to be brief because you've heard most of them. One is related, of course, to patients. One's related to it's a smart financial decision for the state. And one is related to it helps providers participate in the program. And I just want to focus on the first one of those. And I think Dr. Belzer hit on this very articulately. But most importantly, this expansion has been shown to improve health, specifically reduce mortality and improve patients' self-reported health status. And physicians who are providing care for those low-income patients have frequently encountered patients who have severe illnesses that could easily have been prevented, or treated sooner had they had coverage. That alone, I would argue, is reason to pass this legislation. The others are also a positive, and you've heard from everybody else related to that. I do want to point out, however, and take this opportunity, while we strongly support this legislation, and you've heard it raised from others, and Ms. Cox raised this as well, the long-term sustainability of our medical assistance program does require that the state you provide adequate payment levels for physicians and other providers who participate in this program. Senator Benson, I'm sorry she's not in here. She had asked about payment rates on the outpatient side, the physician side. Our payments, fee-for-service payments, have been frozen for 13 years. They have not had an across-the-board increase since 2000. In fact, over the last 3 or 4 years, we have seen significant cuts in certain services, specifically non-primary care physician services, as great as 12% cuts in those services. That's something that I think eventually the legislature has to address and make sure that we have adequate payments. Just 2 weeks ago in this committee, when Commissioner Jessen was providing her overview, she noted that in Minnesota, our fee-for-service payments are 47th in the nation, among the lowest in the nation, the rates that we pay physicians and other outpatient providers. Yet, to the credit of Minnesota physicians, we have among the highest Medicaid participation. 96% of physicians participate in our Medicaid program. We are glad to say that physicians are continuing to participate, but we hear daily that it is getting more and more difficult. And as we expand the program more and more, eventually we do need to address that issue. Currently, we don't have exact numbers of how it compares to commercial because we can't gather commercial rates. But when we compare it to Medicare, our Medicaid payments are about 20% below Medicare. And Medicare is also significantly below commercial rates. And in fact, Midwest and Minnesota specifically is among the lowest in Medicare payments in the country as well. We are pleased that the governor does recommend an increase, about a 5% increase for physician services in the fee-for-service portion of the program. We are very grateful for that. That's a move in the right direction. However, the fee-for-service portion is very small, and we would encourage you as you're putting together your budget to also try to find funds to be able to have a similar increase in the managed care side of that and the PMAP program to ensure that we are funding the program appropriately. Even with those comments, Mr. Chairman and members, again, the Minnesota Medical Association strongly supports this legislation, strongly supports expanding coverage to this population, and I would be happy to continue to answer any questions you all may have. Thank you.
You know, Mr. Renner, both you and the Hospital Association, I need to make clear that we understand that the rates are a problem for our entire provider community, and it really is impressive that you still stand up and speak on behalf of these populations that really need access to service, and that this gives them an ability to come forward and have some payment mechanism so that you're able to step up and do what you came to this industry to do in the first place, and that is provide health care. And it's a real testament to the partnership that we have, and we understand that we should do better than we have and really pay close attention to the rates that our provider community is paid and make sure that they allow for, especially in an environment where we're going to greatly increase the volume of Minnesotans that are going to be coming with this payment structure. It becomes much more important that we pay attention to that and do right by our provider communities, and it's greatly appreciated that you still come forward and help us support these initiatives. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate those comments, and that's nice to hear. I will take that back to our members as a commitment that we will be seeing an increase this year.
I think I said we understand the importance of the issue is what I was trying to get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But in all sincerity, right. We do understand the dynamic. We don't have a target at this point. We need to get a target. I think that, it's also been said in committee several times, we still have a budget deficit in this place. And we have for the last 10 years really been running budget deficits. And over and over and over again, Health and Human Services has done the lion's share of the budget balancing in St. Paul for this entire period. And it's become incredibly problematic, and it's led to the drastic reductions in rates that were otherwise frozen years ago, and becomes more and more untenable for our provider community, for our disability community, for our, you know, our everyone who's looking to be able to lead a, you know, a decent life in this state, and particularly when the economy turns south, you know, people really need those supports. And I'm really proud of our Minnesota and our community and our ability to step up to the plate and provide that care. But it gets really difficult when we don't, when we continually have to do the budget balancing here in this committee and make these difficult decisions. And I have been working hard to make that understood in the broader community and in our leadership so that we can get the best budget target to be able to address some of these unmet needs that have gone, in my opinion, way too long. So that's my commitment, is that I will continue to advocate for a budget target that recognizes the history and allows us the flexibility to begin to address these needs and to get to the true health care reform that I think the Minnesota healthcare community is ready to embrace, and really through the proper oversight that we do here, we can provide the incentives and the tools to the community to really meet the triple aims of healthcare reform. I mean, as the chief author of the health insurance exchange, not to spend too much time on other issues, that's health insurance reform. And what most of us here in this room are really interested in is healthcare reform, to make sure that individuals have better experiences and outcomes in their interactions with the healthcare system. And I know that that's what the healthcare community wants to do too. It's why you came into this field, is to help people, to provide better population-based health, and through the tools that Minnesota has worked hard for decades to create and have on the table, we can do that better population-based health. And then through an achievement of those first two goals, the bending the cost curve does come. It's not right away, and it's not necessarily through the health insurance exchange, but that insurance reform is a foundation upon which to build that health care reform and a recognition of the role of providers, the critical role of providers, and the flexibility to actually succeed in the reforms that we're asking the provider community and all of our healthcare community to bring forward are reliant on us to help craft those tools, and we will be paying very close attention and working very hard to get the right balance. So anyway, any other questions for Mr. Renner? I mean, I know that we had
members. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Matt Schaefer, is he in the room? Okay, we may come back to that. We'll go to Linda Sandvig with the Safety Net Coalition.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, and we are here to thank Senator Sharon for her support of Senate file bringing this important bill before the legislature, and we're here in strongly support of Senate File 5 that would expand MA coverage to all Minnesota citizens with incomes below 138% of poverty level. I think one of the other testifiers talked about that they were here before when we looked at the early expansion up to 75% of poverty. We were here for that. As one of our safety net providers before talked about with the GMC population, that was a very important bill. We see this as the next step as far as the expansion, and we expect that we will be here with Senator Lori's bill for the basic health plan expansion too. For safety net providers, basically looking at who we represent, some of our providers testified already today, the FQHCs, Regions, Hennepin. But basically, we represent community mental health clinics. We represent community mental health centers, outreach programs, dental clinics. Basically, hospitals, the glue that holds our providers together is that we serve a disproportionate number of people that serve medical assistance, public programs, and the uninsured. And actually, if we look at our clientele, part of that is serving the uninsured. So for us, looking at coverage is a primary goal, because more people that we have covered, the less that we have that are non-paying clients. And so for safety net providers, a little different than some other providers, when we cost shift to people that cannot pay. So that is one of the things that I'd like to highlight as far as maybe kind of the difference in this conversation when we look at expansion and healthcare coverage. Many of the people that we serve are very low income. They face barriers to obtain needed services due to income, not only income but language, race, or ethnicity. And an expanded Medicaid program will help to remove the cost barrier that currently provides many low-income, uninsured people from seeking primary care and preventive services. ER services are not the most cost-effective way as far as delivering services. We're hoping that it will also do the other thing that we would like to really highlight, and I think that's been talked about before, is looking at healthcare disparities. Basically, looking at that and improving the outcomes for people of color, according to a report by the Minnesota Department of Health in 2011, while Minnesota is one of the healthiest states in the nation, it also has one of the greatest disparities in health status between populations of color, American Indians, and white. Populations of color and American Indians in Minnesota experience significantly higher rates of chronic and infectious diseases and premature death. A lot of that looks as far as like at the income level. It's not a surprise that we're looking at people of color with low access to insurance and affordability as far as being able to provide adequate health care coverage for those individuals, and we feel that this expansion will greatly improve that. In looking at lessons learned from Minnesota, which had a similar expansion in 06, they've shown that safety net providers will continue to be key source of care for low-income vulnerable populations. In fact, when you looked at coverage in Massachusetts, expanding by 50%, for a lot of the community health centers, it was only 20%. So we would like to add and reinforce that as far as looking at the expansion, this is not a silver bullet, but it is certainly a step in the right direction, and we highly support it. Thank you very much for your support in bringing this important bill before us. We are very supportive. Thank you.
Ms. Sandvig, thank you. We also have Alex Fitzsimmons with the Children's Defense Fund wishing to testify in favor, but I don't see her here either. So with that, I think the public testimony is completed, and we'll get back to the bill. Senator Sharon, and I should say there's a couple of other written testimonies in members' packets that you can refer to at your convenience. Senator Sharon, are you ready to?
Yes. I would like to offer the committee a chance to go through the fiscal note, but prior to that, I'd like to make an amendment to the bill,
okay.
An author's amendment.
Is that the A9?
The A... Nine amendment.
Let's distribute the A9 amendment.
As that is being distributed.
On the amendment, Senator Sharon.
Mr. Chair, I just would like you to know as a committee that this amendment simply adds language to the bill that is reflected in the fiscal note under the revenues, where on the front page of your fiscal note, if you'll note under revenues, there is a numbers that move from fiscal year 14 through fiscal year 17 under healthcare access fund. And this language that's in this amendment authorizes this expenditure from this revenue draw from the healthcare access fund.
And Senator Sharon, when I look at the bill, I see it's just filling in the dot, dot, dots that were in the bill as introduced, so we were waiting to see what the fiscal impact is. We have it in the fiscal note. Seeing that on the A9 amendment, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A9 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. The A9 is adopted. On the bill as amended.
Thank you very much. The revenue fiscal note impact takes into account a number of assumptions. It is, as indicated, you can read through the materials what I think I will highlight, and then I would ask Mr. Albrecht if there are specific questions on the fiscal note to assist us. But the good news is that the fiscal note is showing some savings, which is not always the case when we're looking at fiscal notes, of $129 million in the year 14-15, $237 million in 16-17 in the health care access fund. So with that, unless there are questions, maybe we could just
go to questions. I mean, I think members have had the fiscal notes been out for a couple of days. Members have questions. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, I go back to the Minnesota Care program, and I just question if I'm looking at overall true numbers when we don't know the impact of at least those who are in Minnesota Care that would fall into that 138% and under. I have trouble voting for a bill when I don't know what the true fiscal impact is going to be, and I feel like because of what is stated here in the assumptions that we this isn't necessarily an accurate fiscal note because of what could change with the Minnesota Care program. Could you just address those concerns, please?
Thank you. Go ahead.
Senator Brown, to that, you know, I mean, this is really, this assumption is regarding what's going to happen with Minnesota Care. It's the basic health plan. And it's really an entirely different population. It's that population above 138% of federal poverty level, from there up to 200, and possibly even beyond if we can work with the federal government, because Minnesota Care, of course, goes to 275 for many populations. So, I mean, just to be clear, this note was meant to add some clarity and be straight up with the fact that there is an ongoing discussion about the basic health plan and what the feds are going to allow, but it is a different population than we're talking about in this bill. This bill is expansion up to 138% of federal poverty level with 100% federal support for that for everyone newly eligible under this expansion for the first 3 years, and then beginning to drop off to the point where the feds are still putting up 90% as a stable place. And so if we can, you know, I don't think that this question regarding BHP is really at stake in terms of what happens with the expansion up to 138. But Senator Sharon, you may have additional thoughts.
No, I think you articulated that well, and we are separating those questions now. This really is only asking the committee to take a look at what we can do with the expansions of Medicaid with such a strong partnership from the federal government. The next step, which this discussion that you're asking about will be important for us to consider, has been extracted from this bill. We aren't addressing that yet because we're seeking to understand the rules and the clarification under which we can operate before we bring something forward that will have a variety of considerations in terms of fiscal impact, depending on what the outcome is of those conversations. We're hoping, of course, to be able to access the premium tax subsidies for this population after 138% to help defray costs in health care coverage for those who are currently on Minnesota Care. But that's not the subject of this bill. Now, this stands on its own and provides the savings as indicated in this fiscal note.
Thank you. Senator Rosen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been in and out of this room, and I'm so sorry, Senator Sharon. What is the contingency plan if the dollars don't come through for the future? What is the contingency plan?
In relationship to this bill?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, as you know, I think perhaps you've heard this in other committee hearings as well. We will have to have a conversation about what it is that we will do to support and provide safety net for our population we're talking about here under a couple of scenarios. One is if the state of Minnesota decides not to participate in this expansion, then we are going to have to take a look at how we would not only deal with this new expansion, but the 0 to 100%, who aren't really addressed in the exchange, and also the group that we've already covered under the early expansion. So without our addressing this bill, we will have a huge population to address without federal resources. But I think underlying your question is, if the federal government for some reason changes its mind about its contributions to our Medicaid program, what then? What's the contingency plan? And the Affordable Care Act allows for us at any time without cause to withdraw from participating in this program. We do not have to participate in it today. We lose all sorts of federal resources, federal dollars that our taxpayers are already paying if we don't do that. But we would then have the contingency plan, so to speak, is to go to either not provide coverage for people or to take a look at how we're going to redirect other resources in the state of Minnesota to do that. We are also feeling fairly assured that the federal government will make its commitment. It doesn't have any history or evidence of not ever following through with its commitment in the area of health and human services in terms of providing health care costs. So history doesn't indicate that that's an issue. I've said in other committee meetings that concern, I can understand that coming up from the state legislature, because the state legislature has not been always able to or willing to sustain its commitment to its local partners, local school districts or local counties or local cities. We've withdrawn states' resources from them in terms of health care dollars, but the federal government has not done that. So I think the question for us now is whether or not, as long as this resource is available to us, do we want to participate in it or not? And if it changes in the future, then we come back together and determine what it is we will or will not do as a state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen, the follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you. So if there is a contingency plan that has to go forward, I would assume it involved the Health Care Access Fund. And I'm wondering if Mr. Leitz could come up and give us, or Mr. Ulbricht could go through how much dollars are in the Access Fund going forward. And that's the first question. And just kind of step through the fiscal note a little bit better. I'm struggling with this.
I would ask Mr. Ulbricht to walk through the fiscal note, and then we can wait and see if they can get some numbers. If you have some specific questions for Mr. Ulbricht on the fiscal note, do you have
Mr.
some
Ulbricht.
You want him to walk through more specifically?
Mr. Ulbricht, yes. Mm-hmm. Step us through the fiscal note in a little more detail.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, Senator Rosen, and members of the committee, with respect to Senator Rosen's question about the Health Care Access Fund, I don't have that in front of me, but by the end of 2017, there's a balance of, I believe, maybe even a couple of billion dollars in the Health Care Access Fund. But I will clarify that after committee, but it's at least several hundred million dollars. Going over the fiscal note, as Senator Sharon pointed you to the revenues that show the transfer between the Health Care Access Fund and the General Fund, and that was in the amendment to accomplish that, I would draw your attention to the net expenditures section, which shows that indeed, after you account for the movement of populations between the two funds, there are costs overall in the General Fund of $21 and $42 million for this. For the 14-15 biennium, and savings in the Health Care Access Fund of $58 million and $134.6 million. So if you go down to then the net cost and savings line, that's where the transfer to the General Fund gets netted out of the overall savings in the Health Care Access Fund for the $37 million. And the 92 for a total of $129 million for 14-15 and corresponding $237 million savings. in 16 and 17.
Mr. Chair, at some point, could we have those figures where the health care access fund stands to date?
Yeah. Mr. Albrecht will run and get the health care access fund tracking sheet.
Okay,
we had a copy of it in our budget books, but we don't have those here today. Thought we were done with the budget overview, but we'll get those.
Thank you.
And Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I actually had a question for Mr. Albrecht about the total federal dollars, and perhaps Senator Sharon or Mr. Leitz could address that, because I know we talked about percentages, but the total federal dollars for each of these years, because with the balance in the health care access fund, if the federal dollars are more than that and they go away, we have to have a funding source.
But your question is really what happens if the federal dollars go away?
How
again?
Many federal dollars? And then we can make a plan. But do we know how many federal
Mr.
dollars?
Yeah, they are specified in
are
here.
They? I'm sorry.
And that's fine. I mean, there's a chart on page 3 for the elimination of the asset test that indicates the federal share expected there. There's a little bit on the following chart for the Minnesota Care interactions with a loss of federal share. 19 and 20-year-olds on page 4. The federal share is in that chart. The adults without children don't really have an FFP interaction. The medical assistance for the Minnesota Care side, medical assistance on page 5, it's 100% federal, and so you'll see the federal share there. For Section 6, the eligibility for parents up to 138, again, on the Minnesota Care side, the first part of that chart, there isn't an interaction, but the parents picked up in MA, there is a federal share, so you can tally those 4 years' worth. Those are the federal effects as you step through the fiscal note and read the assumptions. So that those
I
are
apologize.
Anyway.
I was just trying to get a grasp of how big.
What is the total federal? We tallied that up while we were sitting here. The total federal financial share was
about 1.1.
There it is.
1.166 billion.
Over the four-year period.
Total?
Total. Federal share. That's new federal monies.
And Senator Lori, when we're talking about the loss in this bill, we have to remember that under our current approaches to dealing with the safety net population, we are receiving 50% match from the federal government right now.
And, Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate for me to offer an amendment at this time?
Yeah. Senator Benson.
I have the A8 amendment. It is a sunsetting provision, so that if the federal government drops below, I believe Ms. Kavanaugh has it, if the federal government drops below the 90% commitment, that we would revert to the eligibility standards that existed on December 31st, and that the legislature could then make a determination as to what would happen going forward. Because my concern is that as federal dollars, we're currently borrowing 40 cents of every dollar that is promised in this bill. And if the federal government decides to get its house in order by having the states pick up the tab, I would like the opportunity to sit down and make a Minnesota-based decision and not have to comply with what the federal government has dictated and is choosing in this scenario not to fund.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, I would like Mr. Leitz to do some clarification about what's being discussed.
Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I guess. Certainly, I haven't had a chance to look at the amendment specifically, but I think the only thing I would add is the guidance that we have received so far has indicated that, and we don't expect this to change at all, that states can sort of opt in and opt out at when they wish to. So I think if were funding to be terminated or substantially withdrawn or drawn back in some way, I think the state does have the ability to, at its decision, make that change. I think I assume that your amendment, I think, is probably after that same end.
And yes, and Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson,
and Mr. Leitz, this would just be establishing a legislative position that said we would be asking the administration to take action. If the federal government decides they're not going to keep their obligation, then we revert to Minnesota control of this population and policy.
Senator Sharon, reactions? I have some reactions to the way this is crafted. I mean, let's say, certainly, it's my understanding, too. I've worked with the Fed's guidance on what's come out, and I believe we have the ability to opt out of this at any time, whether or not they reduce their funding. I mean, this is an option that the states would always have. And when I read this, let's say we're not in session, and the Feds drop from 90% to 89%, we revert to the 75% threshold for Medicaid and lose 89% federal funding for this entire population. I don't think that that's a wise choice to be offering. I mean, we do have the option at all times to create a Minnesota-based approach, and in such case, that the Feds do reduce it, and it's problematic for our budget and for our state, we're going to take a very serious look at that and call the Feds to task. If it's a significant enough reduction from what the deals we had made prior and we're not in session, I would assume that we'd have to be called back to take a good look at it. But I would be very uncomfortable saying that if the Feds went to 89% for this population, we should just drop the whole approach and go back to what we were on December 31st of 2013. I find this very problematic, but I'd be happy to get your thoughts, Senator Sharon.
Well, thank you, Senator Lurie. I know that this has been a concern, this discussion about what happens if the federal government surprises states and changes its position. I think that the language in the Affordable Care Act is sufficient to assure states, because it is clear, as has been stated, that we can withdraw without any. We don't have to. We can withdraw if we want to, even if the feds are continuing to fund at the level that they've promised. I also don't like the amendment approach, because I prefer a longer, more thoughtful process to consider what we might do based on what the federal government does, which could be a variety of things, although their history indicates they're not going to do that. And finally, I would just remind the committee that in the hearings in front of the Supreme Court about the authority of the federal government to implement the Affordable Care Act, one of the areas that the justices talked about and why this is a voluntary process that we're engaged in right now in terms of the expansion to the Medicaid program was that the justices, because prior to that it was obligatory or losing all of your funding. That was the original language, but that was changed. That strong arm was changed to a voluntary participation, and why we're in front of you, because the judges clearly stated, and I draw this directly from the material, that though Congress has the power to legislate under the spending power, and it is broad, it does not include surprising participating states with post-acceptance or retroactive conditions. Right. And so it was the Supreme Court that articulated that the federal government doesn't have the right to do that.
Right. And I think this was teased out a little bit in some of the testimony. I mean, I don't believe the act has been changed. I believe that the enforcement of it was struck by the courts. And so the act still anticipates this expansion. And so if we don't do this expansion, people that would be covered by Medicaid under this expansion are prevented from getting the advanced premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reductions, because when the act was crafted, It anticipated them being in Medicaid. So if we chose not to do that, we're actually taking this population and preventing them from any level of care. And that's incredibly problematic to think that we might do that in an environment where, you know, the feds are putting up 100% for the first 3 years and then winnowing back to 90. Senator Franson?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect, Senator Benson, I looked at this, and the first impression was this is a solution looking for a problem. And the federal law is the federal law, and I believe that the commitment is 90%. And if they ever go below that, then they're changing federal law, which can happen with numerous laws that we have in place federally. So, I mean, we can hypothetically have a sunset for every law that we pass that is in coordination with the federal government. So this is health care, and in my view, it's not like turning off cable TV and shutting it off and going reverting back to no cable. So it's a bigger implication that I find chaotic, not just problematic.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
That's why it gives 60 days or when the decrease in federal funding becomes effective, whichever is the later. And so if we anticipate that the federal government is going to go through a deliberative budget process and give the states due notice, then we will have time to make adjustments as a legislature. What this very, very clearly states is Minnesota is aware that there is a federal dependency issue and that there is a federal spending problem and there's a federal borrowing problem. And we are not living in a world where we deny, I cannot live in a world where we pretend federal funding is never going to change. We have approaching $17 trillion in debt. We have a sequester coming that will not impact this population, but there will be other changes that will be coming. And the people in Congress are going to have to make very difficult decisions. And the easiest place to go is the last thing that was added, and I am concerned that they will start making changes. And as I see us do to the counties and as I see us do to our agencies, just pushing the responsibilities, not giving maintenance of effort relief. I do not inherently trust that Congress won't say, okay, states, you have to keep this in place, but we're dropping back to 50%. I do not have that much confidence. And I want Minnesota to take a position that says, okay, Congress, you made us a promise, and if you don't keep it, we are taking control back. You don't get to tell us maintenance of effort. I believe we will make good decisions around this table if this ever comes. Mm-hmm. I just want it very clear that I am not going to trust that Congress is going to keep the 90% and not put more maintenance of effort requirements. They grow and grow and grow and grow, and at some point it's got to stop. And that is why I'm offering this amendment. It is not to create chaos. I do not believe this is like cable TV. I am taking this very seriously, and it's a conversation that needs to be had more often as we continue to take federal dollars in hollow promise. They promised they would fund special ed, and we're continually playing catch-up, and they continue to make more requirements in special ed and not fund it. And now we're going down that path with health care. And if the most recent behavior is the best indication of future behavior, we have to have a real acknowledgement that this is a possibility.
With that, any further discussion on the A8 amendment? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
All those in favor of the A8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 5. Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 5, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
The full Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, there was going to be the health care access dollars.
Yes, we will get back. Let's get the description of the health care access fund. Thank you for reminding me, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, members of the committee, with the November forecast, the balance in the Healthcare Access Fund at the end of 2015 is $161 million, and at the end of 2017 is $203 million. Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the larger numbers that I had in my mind were from the governor's budget. So when you look at all of the impacts on the Healthcare Access Fund in the governor's budget, there would be a balance of a little over $300 million at the end of 2015 and a balance about of $1.1 billion at the end of 2017. And the governor's budget also includes a reserve for the demonstration program to deal with basically the basic health care population of $300 million a year. So when you incorporate that, at the end of 2017, there's a balance of about $793 million. And at the end of 2015, this biennium that we're planning for, about $318,000.
Mr. Chair, we'll have that discussion later.
Senator Rosa, okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, on Senator Sharon's motion that Senate File 5, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Oh. Motion carried. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank
that
you.
That concludes the business before the Health and Human Services Finance Division. We stand adjourned.